the Third World War.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, last week, Russian embassy officials in Cuba said Russia planned to deliver oil and oil products to Cuba as humanitarian aid. Just when and how those shipments were to begin was left hanging, described by embassy staff to the TASS news agency only as occurring sometime in the near future. But can Russia afford to take on another front in the undeclared war America and its vassals are waging against it and the rest of an uncooperative world? John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears and has as well served as advisor to governments at the highest level. He's too been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism. Among Helmer's many book titles are The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Skripal in Prison, and the Skripal sequel, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison That Fooled the World. His latest is the newly released The Navalny Novichok Complex, Chronicle of a Staging. John's latest article at Dances with Bears is The Peskovites Are Desperate as Putin Places His Biggest Bet, a behind-the-scenes look at the diplomatic dynamics determining war and or peace between the atomic superpowers. Welcome back to the program, John.
Thanks for having me back, Chris.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. John, before getting to the aforementioned article and some of the revanchist statements from Marco Rubio made at the Munich War-Making Conference, Alexei Navalny has popped up again, this time in a supporting role to an even more wildly implausible conspiracy theory being proposed by the NATO Dream Factory. John, what can you tell us about the dastardly dart frog poison assassination plot?
Well, Chris, it's a very, very peculiar release at this point in time. Why do I say that? Because last September, Yulia Navalnaya, the widow of Alexei Navalny, announced the biological, I'm quoting what she said in a 12-minute video clip released, and you can find it on Dances with Bears back last September. She said biological samples were obtained from Navalny shortly after his death and then transferred for testing by, quotes, laboratories in at least two countries independently. She made the claim that the biological samples had already gone to the labs last September, October, November, December, January, February, 6 months later. We have an announcement from the UK, Sweden, France, Germany, and the Netherlands, which the only, as it were, clinical or forensic detail that's new is that epibutidine is the toxin drawn from frogs, which has been found in Navalny's tissues. Now, why did it take 6 months? Well, it may have taken 6 months to come up with a synthesized version of epibutidine in one of the laboratories. But when you look carefully at the joint statement of UK, Sweden, France, Germany, and the Netherlands, you don't see, is what I meant, any substantial evidence they're ready to release to prove what they claim. Instead, they claim, and I'm just looking at it, reading it, the UK, Sweden, France, Germany, and the Netherlands are, quotes, confident that Alexei Navalny was poisoned with a lethal toxin. This is the conclusion of our governments based on analyses of samples from Alexei Navalny. They've conclusively confirmed the presence of epibutidine. Well, if it's conclusive from the lab, why are the states merely confident? And why don't they produce the results?
I'll just assume off the top that this is bullshit. They've told nothing but lies up to now, these people that would come up with these weird things, as well as with poisoning plots against Skripals and all that. So, but why now? Why? What's the point of this attack to come after? Clearly, nobody cares about Navalny anymore, if they ever cared about him at all. Why would they even come out with such a thing, do you think?
I think there are two reasons, but before I answer that question, Chris, let me go to one little forensic investigation I did myself. I asked toxicology sources in the UK, what do they know about this epibutidine and how can it be produced in the form of a stable enough injectable poison to kill anyone? And here's the toxicology result I'm getting. Technically, the frog is the producer of the toxin, but the toxins are generated by the ants and other insects which the frog eats. And then the frog converts the toxic materials of its appetite, of its dinner, of its lunch and its breakfast, into the poison. So to produce a poison in Russia, as alleged, a laboratory would have to supply not only frogs, but insects that are present in the frog's natural environment. And what's more, this toxicologist says, these frogs do not produce this toxin in captivity. So a lab would have to simulate the Amazon jungle, surround the frogs with juicy Amazonian insects and other bugs in order to produce an Amazonian environment capable of generating the toxin. Now, that sounds even more ludicrous, doesn't it? But I see the timing slightly differently. Clearly, as you said, the political value of Alexei Navalny has diminished to the vanishing point inside Russia and outside Russia since the war has escalated. The war against Russia has escalated not only in the Ukrainian battlefield, but elsewhere in Europe and on the high seas. So to generate continuing public support for the European version of the war against Russia, no concessions on the Ukraine battlefield, escalation in the North Sea, the Baltic Sea, the Danish Straits, the Atlantic, and so forth, to keep sustaining public support, the image of Russia as an attacker of Europe on European values, on European territory, continues to have propaganda value as they calculate it. These are the states that sent their national security men to Geneva to sit beside the Ukrainian delegation in the talks that have just wound up today. But second, as Navalny's political value in Russia has disappeared, the problem of the splitting of the Navalny organization, Yulia Navalny, the widow, plus her colleagues, Yarmush and other people, are running out of money. They make money. They are subsidized or paid directly by CIA, MI6, BND, the German intelligence agency. And they have to convince their paymasters that they can still serve the political function that Alexei Navalny himself served. So what Navalny has done is essentially come up with an even more dramatic version of her value than she tried last September. Now, that last September announcement, which people have forgotten, turned out to be a damp squib. The poison that she alleged at the time had been identified drew almost no journalism interest and no propaganda value. So she's trying again. Why? Because it pays for her. And if it fails again, maybe we will either hear yet another preposterous story supported by the European allies, or she will disappear for good. And the timing coincides because of the Munich Security Conference, because of the Abu Dhabi round of negotiations earlier this month, and now the Geneva round beginning. The timing coincides with the very determined effort by the Europeans and some factions of the US to resist any form of peace on the battlefield with Russia and long-term security arrangements short of war with Russia for the rest of Europe. The timing will always be appropriate for that so long as this war continues. And it's going to continue.
They risk the credulity of their audience, or maybe they don't. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with John Helmer. John's a journalist. He's an author. He's spent decades living and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. He's as well served as advisor to governments at the highest level and been a professor at some of the most prestigious universities teaching political science, sociology, and journalism. Among his book titles, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Skripal in Prison, and the sequel, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison That Fooled the World. His latest is The Navalny-Novichok Complex, Chronicle of a Staging. It's a pity that your book came out before the frog thing. You could have maybe got a whole chapter out of that, John. I really want to talk about the Geneva meeting, and you've written about this in the in your latest article, The Peskovites Are Desperate as Putin Places His Biggest Bet, and the previous article, Stab in the Back. But before, can we briefly touch on, as I teased in the intro, John, the remarks made by the embassy in the Russian embassy in Cuba to TASS that Russia would be supplying oil to Cuba, running the embargo, the blockade. Will they?
Very good question, Chris. And the Russian side is not making a credibly deterrent answer. Here's what we've got. On the one hand, we have a very significant faction in policymaking faction in Moscow, headed by Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, and almost certainly endorsed by the GRU military intelligence, general staff, the intelligence services, civilian intelligence services. We have opposition to the U.S. escalation of the war against Russia at sea. That's extended the blockade of Venezuela in the Caribbean, to Cuba in the Caribbean, and to all of the high seas of the world, including the Baltic, the Danish Straits, the North Atlantic, and the Indian Ocean, in the most recent tanker seizures and interceptions. Cuba has been promised Russian aid and not simply oil. Solidarity has been expressed by Sergei Lavrov with the Cuban people. I might say that Lavrov and the Russian position has been solidarity with the people of Venezuela and with the successor regime of President Maduro, without it being clear that the Russian side is prepared to do anything to defend in Venezuela. Will it defend in Cuba? Will China and Russia, which maintain a very important intelligence installation in Cuba, defend Cuba by deterring a U.S. blockade that's squeezing Cuba economically? Well, what does that require logistically? It requires oil, either crude oil, or petroleum products, oil products, diesel, mazut, and ship bunkers, all to be shipped by tanker as soon as possible to Cuba. Is there any evidence that there are Russian cargoes on Russian flag vessels heading to Cuba in the Caribbean at the moment? I'm afraid I don't know, but I don't see any evidence of that. Second, when the announcement was made of in general support for Cuba, in general solidarity and practical support for Cuba, the foreign ministry appeared to modify or qualify the statement by saying petroleum products, particularly jet fuel, would be supplied to Cuba in order to assist the humanitarian evacuation of Russian tourists stranded in Cuba because there's no fuel for aircraft to fly in and then fly out. So the Russian announcements, primarily from the foreign ministry, appear to suggest petroleum products supply to Russians in Cuba, not to the Cubans. And that may require negotiation between the Russian foreign ministry and the U.S. authorities so that such shipments of petroleum products would not be intercepted or otherwise threatened by the U.S. But that's helped not to Cuban people, but to Russian people in Cuba.
What about, John, Russia's oil trade with Venezuela? Were they shipping oil out of Venezuela before the American attack and kidnap of President Maduro?
Good question, and I would like to be more precise. I think the following has happened. The Chinese were shipping Venezuelan oil cargoes out. There'd be no point in Russia shipping out Venezuelan oil cargoes, but the Marinera tanker that was intercepted, seized, arrested, and confiscated after a chase from off the Venezuelan coast in the Caribbean to the North Atlantic off the Scottish and Iceland coasts by the United States in collaboration with the British. That was a Russian-flagged vessel, flagged en route, as it were, and it was empty, but it was not carrying Russian cargo out of, or Russian, Venezuelan oil out of Venezuela in the direction of Russia. It was heading for a Russian port at the time it was intercepted, but it was empty. Now, if I try to remember, because I'm losing track in my old head of how many tankers have been intercepted with Russian oil and how many Russian flag tankers have so far been intercepted and seized by the United States. For the time being, I can't think of any evidence that Russia is taking oil or took oil out of Venezuela as the Chinese were doing in the so-called teapot trade. That's heavily discounted Venezuelan oil, now Russian oil going to China in the same way, heavily discounted to the independent refineries in southern China that act very opportunistically in the market to buy cheap and sell dear. The teapot trade is a Chinese business. It was involved Venezuela, but also everyone elsewhere offering discounted oil. India has now stepped in and said it will take Venezuelan oil cargoes through the U.S. mechanism that's been set up. But I don't see that the Russian side has done anything to, let's say, defend the oil production that Russian joint ventures in Venezuela is making from port to sale. In other words, it's Russian shared, Russian equity oil produced in oil fields in Venezuela that would have to be called Venezuelan oil, wouldn't it?
Well, and that's important. Now, if we can get to your stab in the back now, and Geneva peace talks or whatever you want to call them, whatever kind of talks they are. I mean, it's really all around money in the end. And I saw you on an interview, I think it was on Dialogue Works, but talking about the Russian oil prices collapsing and down to, what was the number, $60 US a barrel or even below that or something because of all of this pressure?
It's below 40 at the
40.
There are reports that it's the net price back to Russia that we need to be focusing on. As the Americans increase the blockade against all Russian movement of oil and against all Russian fleets, tankers, the so-called shadow fleet, the price at which the Russian crude can be sold is significantly below the published markers, the Brent price, the West Texas Intermediate price, or the Urals price. These are published markers, but refineries and intermediaries buying for refineries in various parts of the world buy at a discount, and they increase the discount, and Russia has to accept the discount as the pressure on delivery increases. The Turkish refineries have dramatically cut their intake of Russian crude oil for their refining purposes. You see, it's simple. Buy cheap and sell dear. Buy Russian oil as cheap as possible, then sell on to Europe and other consumers of petroleum products at as high a price as you can get. It's a good business to be in if you're in it. And the US is generating such a squeeze on Russian supply, Russian tankering, that the discount has been growing. But one has to be careful also of Bloomberg's, Reuters, and other US propaganda, Western propaganda agencies for exaggerating the damage that this is doing to Russian oil revenues. But it's not worth the contrary propaganda position of saying this is no damage at all, pinpricks. This is not the case.
Well, okay, so John, Geneva's coming up, and I'm talking fast because we only have a few more minutes, but what's going on in Geneva? What can we expect? You've written these articles basically about a factional split, it looks to me, like a schism. You describe it as also being a two-track thing. I don't know if this is a cunning move by the Russians to confuse the Americans or what, but it looks like you've said that there's this lack of faith in Putin and that he's giving away the farm and the ghost of Gorbachev and the other clown that sold out.
Boris Yeltsin.
Yeltsin. The specter of these two guys selling Russia down the river. Is Putin ready to wear those shoes or what?
Well, let me come to the answer because we're running out of time to just point out for our audience that the second day of the Geneva talks has now been completed. Okay, the only Russian press statement that had been promised to give anyone any idea of the outcome of these talks has come in a 23-second clip presentation by Vladimir Medinsky, the junior Kremlin aide who was the head of the Russian delegation. He indicated that there'd been 6 hours of talks, 4 hours the first day, 2 hours the second day. They will continue without a date for the next round of meetings. But there's no concrete result on any of the issues that were under negotiation. These include how much of the Novorossiya regions, the four regions, Kherson, Zaporozhye, Donetsk, and Lugansk, will be included as the Russian territories acquired by the war. That's first point. Second, there's been no resolution of the claims for who will control the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant, a major source of energy in eastern Ukraine, and now controlled by the Russian side, but constantly under attack from the Ukrainians. No resolution on Zaporozhye. No resolution on the kinds of security guarantees the Russian side tabled. And we presented the paper. I believe it was about 30-point paper that Russian side spelled out last year. No resolution, no agreement on those points. Those are summarized and sloganized by the Ukrainian side, by the Anglo-American press, by the Canadian press as ceasefire, security guarantees for the Ukraine, and things of that nature. There's no outcome of these talks yet. So Geneva, the two-day talks in Geneva, have proved to be a damp squib, although President Trump has tweeted to the effect prior to the opening of the talks that they should be easy and the Ukraine should come to the table. He made it appear that his pressure is on the Ukraine to come to the Russian terms. Well, they haven't. They haven't. On the other hand, behind the scenes on the Russian side and between the Russian side's negotiator with the Americans, Kirill Dmitriev, there are significant differences of view and policy. And that's what the pieces you referred to, Chris, are about. I wouldn't so much say split as differences of opinion appropriate to this time. Dmitriev thinks he has come to an agreement with Steven Bitkoff, Jared Kushner, and Joshua Gruenbaum, and other U.S. business interest representatives on a deal for resuming U.S.-Russian economic relations business compensating for the losses, as Dmitriev has called them, of U.S. oil companies and other corporations that exited when sanctions were imposed. Since sanctions were imposed illegally, to suggest that the U.S. side has suffered losses from such a thing is a form of U.S. talking that Dmitriev's engaged in. Dmitriev was also at the Geneva talks, but had separate talks on the U.S.-Russian economic plan with Witkoff and Kushner. And Dmitriev has only tweeted from Geneva, and I'm looking at his tweets of the last few hours. He quotes the White House as saying constructive talks. He quotes The Economist as saying that Russia has offered $12 trillion in deals in exchange for lifting sanctions. And according to Dmitriev, four hours ago by tweet, he says this is fake news. That's because the potential portfolio of U.S.-Russia projects is over $14 trillion. This sort of silly arithmetic indicates how far Dmitriev's gone into the U.S. corner to abandon almost all of the major Russian positions, including de-dollarization of trade payments.
Well, isn't that what it's all about, the re-dollarization, allowing the American dollar? This is where the Americans are the most worried. I would think that all around the world that there's alternate mechanisms to the American dollar and the SWIFT system.
I agree with you, Chris, and Dmitriev stands for abandoning that policy, the BRICS policy, the Russian policy.
And he's Putin's man, though. Does that mean that Putin is ready to re-dollarize?
The answer's half yes, half no. Putin is a political balancer, not necessarily a strategist. He must balance, and that's the reason, that's the explanation of the last piece. He must balance on a wager that you can trust the Americans, the Trump administration. He must balance between the war objectives of the special military operation, now endorsed and promoted by, obviously, the General Staff, the Intelligence Services, and the Foreign Ministry. He must balance those with the Dmitriev position that you've got to bribe and induce and reward the Americans for relieving Russia of the sanctions war. So Putin is balancing between the two factions. Now, how can you balance positions, policy positions as contradictory as those two at the same time as one faction, let's call it the Lavrov faction, says you can't trust the Americans to do anything, to honor any of their commitments?
Well, that sounds like a pretty wise position, or an obvious one, I would say. Sorry, John, that we've got only about 30 seconds left. Go to John's website, johnhelmer.net, Dances with Bears, to read the two articles that we're talking about here today. Thanks a lot, John, for coming on. Thanks to Randy Caravaggio. Remember that Victoria Friends of Cuba, contact them. The contact stuff is in the notes in this show that will appear up at my site, Substack. Thanks a lot, John, for coming on again, eh?
Thank you very much for having me, Chris. And to everybody listening, don't get too close to any colorful frog you see popping up.
Ribbit. Take it easy. That's all I got for this week. Until the next time. Every system on the blink in the moments before the Third World War.
A time it has arrived where we wonder, will our species survive when for our taxes all we get are yet more missiles and fighter jets, when the arms race reaches ignition point and someone decides to blow the joint, set in motion a chain event the day after we wonder where the planet went in the moments before the Third World War.